courts under much more stress. Rubble and drifts of scree were scattered along the floor. The pockmarked pillars looked moth-eaten.
Jeez, Luke muttered. Looks like all it'd take is a good push.
You do this room. Use every fuse. Concentrate on the pillars in the middle. Then you wait right here. Don't move until I come back. At the entrance, he turned back. If I don't say your name, you light up whoever comes in here and blow their heads off.
You don't have to tell me twice, Luke said. Good luck.
Wish people would stop saying that.
He took the tunnel at a run, spotted another X and a down arrow. After clattering down the stairs, he dog-legged left, trotted another length of corridor, and then saw the room yawning to his right. This chamber was very different. Not only a forest of spindly stone pillars, but a huge ball, rotten from the inside with stress fractures radiating out in a sphere. The walls were a warren of fissures and nearly horizontal seams in gray rock. He studied the seams, saw how the cracks tracked and split the rock. This was like the rotting timber of a neglected basement beneath a house of solid stone. Take out the timber, core out the walls, and the room above, hell, the whole house would fall. He got busy, first fitting two charges, one to each of two pillars. Then he climbed along the walls, digging his boots into the crevices and crannies and using his fingertips to hoist himself into hollowed-out seams where miners had scraped rock with chisel and hammers. He set charges as far back as he could maneuver, using the points of his toes to push himself into the seams. Jagged stone grabbed and scoured his back and stomach, bit into his legs. He worked feverishly, squirming into a seam, backing out, flipping onto his back at another, and fixing a charge to rock that was just inches from his nose. He was on his sixth seam when a new idea occurred to him. Setting off the delay devices to each and every charge would take too long. But if I only have to set off one... He wriggled out and squatted on the rock, pulled out four, five, and then six lengths of time fuse, thought about it. Then he went to work with his knife and the duct tape, knitting the lengths together until they radiated in a huge spider web. 30 feet, 45 seconds a foot, almost 25 minutes. No need for a time delay. With all this extra fuse, this room might actually go last of all, but the explosion would be the most powerful and concentrated. If Weller was right, all that separated this room from the Chucky's were 60 feet of lousy rock. The floor would simply give way. Might even punch through to the flooded levels, and if there are enough pockets of hydrogen sulfide, they'll explode. He ripped off another strip of duct tape with his teeth, then scooped up the rock he'd used to keep the fuse from curling back. If they ignite, then he heard a sudden loud scrape of rock against rock as someone kicked aside stone. At the noise, Tom turned, a little annoyed. Hadn't he just told Luke not to move, to stay put? God, if he'd been just a bit jumpier, he might have shot the kid. But that was when Tom registered two things at once. For one thing, he couldn't have shot Luke because he'd been stupid enough to leave his Uzi propped next to his pack. And for another, he had visitors. The girl had probably been in a lot of trouble before she turned. Maybe she'd been into drugs or a gang, or maybe it was abuse. The scar slashing across her face could have been from a knife. The jittery boy's outfit reminded him of a ninja's, a bandolier of M430 grenades sagged around the kid's scrawny shoulders. Without a launcher, the grenades wouldn't arm and weren't a problem. Scarface's shotgun, though... Chapter 76. Alex had only got good and hammered once, and all alone, the very first time she'd ventured with her friends, Glock and Jack, into her aunt's basement. There was nothing fun about her being drunk, no sense of relaxation or euphoria or even the giggles, just a sickening swoosh in her head, not spinning so much as falling backward in place and being sucked into very deep water. Closing her eyes only made things 5,000 times worse, the blackness behind her lids going round and round and round. She didn't get sick or weepy, but the next time she got cozy with the Glock, she took it easy with that bottle of Jack. That feeling of tumbling into a black whirlpool was this.
God, no. Why no?
She gritted her teeth, fighting against the vertiginous swirl. Of course, she knew why. He was thinking about her, planning what he would do. Worse, the movie in his mind was already running, the images flickering in a blistering bright montage. Alex flailing as Leopard pinned her to the rocks, clamped a hand around her throat to keep her from screaming while the other hand ripped and tore away her.
Stop!
She slapped her right cheek, a stinging blow that jerked out a breath and cut tears. For an instant, the images broke apart the way a pond's perfect reflection of sky and trees fractures the instant you shatter the surface with a rock.
Come on, stay with it.
She slapped herself a second and then a third time, much, much harder, enough that the sharp crack echoed. Something seemed to snap in her head, a jagged flash of white sliced through that deadening swirl, and that awful feeling of falling evaporated as her mind cleared. She was panting. Leopard's aroma was hot and heavy and cloying, like boiled honey laced with sewage, and he must have just eaten because his breath was foul, thick with the greasy stink of fat and wet copper. The yellow spray of his light was a dusty glow, growing firmer and more coherent by the second. She scrambled back like a crab, stumbling over Daniel in her rush. She heard Daniel's breathing change, and she had a split second when she thought maybe now would be a good time to scream while she still had the chance.
Stupid. No one would hear or help, and she was too deep anyway.
The only person who gave a damn about Leopard was Spider, who must be busy somewhere, maybe filleting steaks for the chow line. The spear of light swept into the drift like a searchlight and tacked her into place. Squinting against the sudden brilliance, she put up a hand to shield her eyes, but couldn't see anything. The light left her for an instant and found Daniel, who barely reacted. His eyelids twitched and his head rolled. He swallowed, but that was all. No help there, no help anywhere. The light slid back and held on to her for a good 5 seconds. Now that she knew what to expect, she braced herself against another mental slip, but the monster was either playing possum, or she really might be able to control this after all. Anyway, nothing happened. If she lived through the next 10 minutes, she might even figure out why it had happened at all. Click. Full dark. All she saw were purple afterimages of Leopard's head and shoulders and the outlines of his Uzi. Could she get the gun? Her ears tingled. She heard a slight shush, a whisper of cloth and leather, and then the grind of metal against rock.
Putting down his gun.
His boots crunched closer. Rock squealed. She got her feet tucked under in a crouch. The geometry of the tunnel was simple. Daniel was on her right, Leopard was ahead and a little to her left. Because he was right-handed, he'd worn the Uzi in a cross-carry that could be shrugged off his right shoulder, so his weapon was on her left. One gun down. Leopard normally wore that Glock tucked in his waistband. Had she seen it earlier in the day? She couldn't remember. She felt him move closer. His smell was huge now, a boiling black fog. His breath was ragged and sour with excitement. Click. Light, hot and bright, shining directly into her eyes. The brightness was so intense it felt like needles, and she could feel the tears spilling down her cheeks. Leopard was only 10 feet away, no more, and he had a decision to make. If he stayed true to the brief glimpse she'd seen of what he wanted, then he needed both hands. Hard to take a struggling girl one-handed. So either he'd turn off the light or put it down to free up his hands. She bet he put it down. From what she'd seen, the change didn't absolutely need the light, but she thought he'd brought it so she would understand just what was going to happen, or maybe he wanted her to not only feel what he would do to her, but see it too. He might also leave the light on out of habit. In his previous life, Leopard was probably the kind of guy who liked to watch. Then Leopard surprised her. Sidestepping to his right, his eyes on her the whole time, he wedged the flashlight between two timber supports at waist level. Smart. Keep the light on her and behind him. But when he sidled away, her gaze clicked to his waist and she got a good look because Leopard wasn't wearing a jacket. After all, the mine was relatively warm and he figured on working up a sweat. All of a sudden he was there, so fast she had no time to spring from her crouch or knee his balls or jam her thumbs into his eyes. 1 minute he was 10 feet away and the next he was slamming her into the rock. Her head bounced against stone, pain detonated in her skull and the air bolted from her lungs. Breathlessly, she bucked and flailed as he rode her, his weight on her chest, his hands scrabbling to grab her arms. She swiped with her left hand and felt her nails, jagged and cracked, rake his face. He jerked away with a grunt of pain, and in the light she saw sudden rails of blood. His grip loosened, and then she was rearing up, cocking her right fist, aiming for his Adam's apple. His hand shot out. Deflecting the punch, he grabbed her wrist, then jammed his knee into her bad left shoulder, grinding the bone into the rocks. She screamed. He hit her, a fast open slap and much harder than she had managed on her own. A bomb of pain exploded just beneath her left eye. Her mind blanked and her arms loosened up. In a kind of haze, she saw him winding up to hit her again. From somewhere beyond the tunnel came a low boom, faint but unmistakable. A shotgun. Leopard stiffened and she felt his weight shift, felt the pressure against her shoulder ease as he craned over his shoulder. Grab it! Her left hand pistoned, her fingers found hard polymer, and then she was yanking the Glock free. She jammed the muzzle into Leopard's stomach, right at his navel. A Glock is a Glock is a Glock, and the beauty of a Glock, no active safety, nothing the owner has to remember to flip off and on, just point and shoot. So Alex knew Glocks very well. She'd had days to study this one. She'd watched Leopard kill Ray with it. She knew a cider lock when she saw one, because she'd installed the very same on her dad's Glock herself, so her father's Glock had a cross-trigger safety. But Leopard's didn't. The only gamble was whether Leopard kept around chambered, no time to check or even jack the slide, because that took two hands and she had only one. Big gamble. Her best and only shot. She took it. Chapter 77. The rack of the pump was a nightmare that echoed and bounced off rock. Ka-ka-chunk, crunk, crunk. Tom let a rock fly in a hard, vicious cut, a frisbee throw that was two parts arm, three parts wrist. The rock whirred and struck the girl square in the chest just as she swung the shotgun up, because Tom had seen that she was sloppy and overconfident, racking the shotgun before she'd even slotted the butt or brought the muzzle to bear. Total time, maybe a 2 second jump, but he grabbed it. The shotgun boomed. He was instantly deafened. Light sheeted in a bright tongue of muzzle flash, but he was still alive to see it. He would not have a second chance. Either his Uzi or her shotgun, and his Uzi was closer. He hurtled to his right, but now she was pivoting, racking the shotgun, leading, anticipating where he would land. He just had time to think. Too late. He never heard the shot because the sound was small and his hearing was still gone, but the pain he expected, the rip of buckshot through his body, never came. In another second, he banked to the rock and he swept up his Uzi. The girl was falling, her shotgun slipped from her fingers. In the dark of the tunnel beyond, Tom saw another quick flash as someone shot at the jittery kid, but the boy was already peeling away in a brassy twinkle. His heart boomed, something he felt but could not hear over a loud, burring hum. A crazy thought bounced around in his skull. Many more shots in close quarters, and he was going to go deaf. He waited, quivering, his breath tearing in and out of his throat as the light grew brighter, and then he saw enough to understand who was there. "I'm over here," he said, not bothering to whisper now. He aimed his Uzi at the ceiling. Luke rounded the corner. His skin was pale. His lips moved.
"You okay?"
"Yeah, thanks for not listening." Tom heard a faint hissing as sound started leaking through the hum. Luke's worried face broke into a lopsided grin. "I would have stayed put, except I spotted the kids and saw they were headed right for you." His eyebrows lifted as he saw the jury-rigged network of time fuses.
"Whoa, that's cool."
"Yeah." It hit him that all his work might be for nothing. When the jittery kid got back with his friends, all they had to do was cut the fuses. He thought about the two spare bricks of C4 in his pack. "Come on, we got to block off this room and then get out." He had Luke slap a brick on one side of the entrance as he fixed the other to the highest point of the arch. Jamming a blasting cap on a time fuse into each, he used his knife to cut the debt cord in half.
All right, go. Get to your charges and start the delays. If I don't show in 30 seconds, don't come back this time.
Luke's eyes raked his face, probably to see if he was serious.
I mean it, Tom said.
Luke's head jerked a quick nod. But please come, Tom. Please.
Oh, believe me, I plan on it.
As Luke pelted off, Tom darted back into the room, pulled 2 M60 igniters from his pack, then dug out a lighter and flicked it to life. He touched off the spiderweb. Just hope the explosion at the door doesn't blow this stuff early. If it did, he would never get clear in time. Dashing to the entrance, he looked down the tunnel. Luke was already out of sight. Maybe a minute had passed since the shotgun blast. Tucking his lighter into a hip pocket, he pulled out an igniter, removed the shipping plug, then threaded in the loose end of the time fuse as far as it would go. Tightening the cap, he removed the safety pin. Wash, rinse, repeat with the second fuse. Do it right the first time. The M60s could be rearmed in a pinch, but he really didn't want to do that. Grabbing the pull ring, he pushed, rotated, pulled, heard the sharp pop as the igniter fired.
Hurry, hurry, hurry.
He knelt by the other igniter, grabbed, pushed, rotated, pulled the ring. Pop! He ran. Chapter 78. The boom was enormous, a roar that crashed and broke and reverberated against and over the rocks. The Glock bucked as the round ripped into Leopard's gut. He flopped in a sudden, spastic, loose-limbed jerk like a marionette whose puppeteer had just been goosed. In the yellow light, his blood spray was dark orange. Blowback splattered her hands and drizzled over her face. Leopard began to crumble, already so much dead weight. Bucking him off, she rolled and hung there on hands and knees, the Glock still fisted in one hand. She knew she was panting, but she couldn't hear herself well. The sound was muffled and far away. How long since she'd squeezed off that shot? 5 seconds, 10 at most? Was there someone else down here? She couldn't tell. That shotgun had sounded very far away, but if she could hear them, they might have heard the Glock and come running. She had no time. She and Daniel had to get out. Movement, left. She jerked, the Glock coming up. Daniel? She knew she'd spoken because she felt the air leave her mouth. The stench of burned gunpowder and Leopard's blasted guts filled her nose. Blinking away blood, she scuttled to where Daniel had levered himself to a sit, his back against the rock. He stared at her with wide eyes, and she realized how she must look, blood glistening on her face and hands, slopping over her chest. Daniel, it's Alex. His lips moved. She thought he mouthed her name. No time for this. Laying the Glock aside, she grabbed his shoulders and shook until his head flopped, put her face right into his. Daniel! Daniel! Can you stand? Come on, talk to me! Alex? She heard that. His eyes pulled together, zeroing in on her face. His eyebrows crawled to a frown. Alex? What? Time. Daniel, come on, get up, stand! Stand up! She took fistfuls of parka. We've got to go. Can you walk? Can you fight?
Fight,
he said, as if she were speaking Swahili.
I...
Something shot out of the dark off her right-hand shoulder. She gasped, startled, and then she saw the fluttering outlines of a bat flash in and out of the light before darting into the main tunnel.
Shot must have spooked it.
More bats hurtled through the drift. The roof of this tunnel was arched, but not high, only 10 feet at most. Ducking, she felt the air whisk over her hair as the animals pinwheeled past.
She would have time to get them both out. If Daniel could walk, that would be good, but she'd drag him if she had to.
Kneeling, she rolled Leopard, her eyes noting the fist-sized hole the bullet had chunked in line with his spine. His blood was leaking over the rocky floor in a purple pool. Working fast, she stripped off Leopard's leg sheath and knife, then slapped the pockets of his cargo pants. Her fingers found the familiar outlines of 2 spare magazines for the Glock in the pocket of his right thigh, and then another full mag for the Uzi.
All right.
She slotted the mags into her own pockets, and then she was buckling the sheath around her right calf. We don't have any choice but to go back the way we came. She gave the straps a yank and cinched them tight, but her mind was already jumping ahead, planning their next moves. Got to find the stairs. Maybe I'll smell more changed when we're closer, and that'll point us in the right direction. She heard Daniel moving, the grind and squeal of stone, and she froze. Because his scent was suddenly bitter and rank, and there was no mistake. Her mind slewed and skipped, and then she saw herself on the rocks, a splash of crimson coating her throat from where he would bite and tear. She could feel the sharp spike of phantom stone against her back, and taste how very salty and yet sweet her blood was in his mouth, and this was the smell and the sight of her death. Her gaze inched right. Daniel was slumped against the rock. The ghosts of her hands were stenciled in blood on his shoulders. The Glock's black eye wandered because Daniel was shaking, but it stared right at her, more or less. She opened her mouth. Nothing came out, not even air. His face clenched in panic and new dread, and she saw and smelled that he knew, finally, what was happening to him. She'd guessed right then about why Spider had left them together. Alex didn't hunt, but she knew kids who had. Bag that first deer and you were blooded, wearing your kill as a coppery smudge on your forehead like ashes the day after Fat Tuesday. Daniel was to be blooded with her, or maybe it was no more complicated than a spider making an egg sac and then cocooning a great big bug. Once Daniel was hatched, Spider knew he would need a nice, fresh body upon which to feed.
I can't, Daniel said. You know, I know you do, Alex. You should have. No.
She dragged up her voice from where it had fallen. Daniel, you're talking to me. You know me. You're still here with me. Maybe it'll be different for you. We don't know if... No. His head moved from side to side. His hand was oily from leopard's blood, and now she watched in numb horror as he brought his fingers to his nose. A second later, the pink snake of his tongue slithered out for a taste. The changed don't eat the changed. Every molecule of air left her lungs. She watched the emotions race across his face, revulsion and fear and hunger. His cheeks worked, and then he spat a gobbet of red foam. The Uzi was behind her and too far away. She had the knife, but she'd never get to it in time. She didn't know how to throw it anyway.
Alex,
his voice thrummed with need. His teeth were orange, his eyes were too bright, and she smelled exactly what would happen next.
I don't think I can stop it. I don't know that I even want to.
Yes, you do, she said. Daniel, you fought them all this time.
But I'm so tired, he said. I can feel it growing. I think... I have to.
No, she thought, wildly. This is a cancer, too. This is a monster. Daniel, you know me. You're talking to me. You're not one of them. You're still you.
But I won't be for much longer. I can feel me going away, like trying to catch fog. Can't grab myself anymore.
His chest heaved, and then he was panting, forcing out the words.
You can't. You don't know what it's like to lose yourself piece by piece.
But she did. She pulled in a shuddering, sobbing breath.
You have to try, Daniel. If you do this, it wins. I know.
His head sagged back against the rock, and he closed his eyes, but only for a second.
Jack, oh, Jack, oh, my fault. I'm so sorry.
Daniel, she began. He pressed the muzzle under his jaw.
Oh, God,
he said. Chapter 79. She heard it twice, the blast 5 feet away, and then 10 seconds later, its shadowy, distant cousin. That, she thought, must be her mind finally blowing itself apart. The burn of gunpowder hung in a hazy curtain. Everything else was a shock of red and black. Then the walls shuddered and the ground twitched. She was shaking that hard. Her first, her only thought was that she was in shock. She was falling apart, her mind splitting into pieces, maybe for good. Maybe the monster was tired of the game and had decided to flex its muscles, take that great big drippy final bite. She thought that might be all right. But the world didn't fade. She didn't pass out or die or go crazy. Her eyes were a camera, and with every blink, the snick-snap of a shutter took the same picture. Red and black, and red and Daniel's eyes, and black and Daniel's eyes, and Daniel's dead dark eyes. The rock shimmied again. This time she heard the tick of stone bouncing over stone, and the distant rumble of an explosion. Chapter 80. Chris might have seen it coming if he hadn't insisted that Nathan sleep first. He'd pulled the last watch before they moved out, and he wasn't on top of his game or thinking very straight. Big mistake. The trail they followed was a line of utility poles erected down a narrow stripe of clear-cut, hemmed by a thick tangle of hardwood and pine on either side. The woods knit together at intervals in a dense canopy, but the way through was largely obstacle-free. At ground level, the clear-cut was a straight, open shot and might shave off a good 5 miles that they would otherwise spend in a looping meander through woods. The trail was a temptation that, in other circumstances, Chris would have been smart enough to avoid. Staying undercover and blending in with the darkling shadows was always a better option. It was that canopy that gave him a false sense of security, as well as the fact that they were moving at night. Both would hide them well enough, and the full moon was painting the trail into a glowing green brick road that was just too good not to take.
2 more days, just 2 more.
Chris's head thumped with weariness. The wind was a knife, the cold making him stupid. His snowshoes were lead weights. He was dead on his feet, moving out of habit more than design.
Then we'll be there, and maybe we can find those kids.
Nathan's sorrel was breaking trail about 40 yards ahead, just past a wedge of ghostly verdigris shadow. A big gap. Normally, they were no more than 10 yards apart, but Lena had been sick again, and Chris waited for her to finish.
Just another couple hours, and then we'll stop to rest,
Chris said as he helped her back into the saddle. The roan did an unhappy tap dance as Lena sank into the saddle, and then Chris saw the horse's ears pin back and felt the animal tense.
Lena, pull its head up and tighten the reins. Easy, he said as the roan tried an abortive buck and then settled, blowing hard.
Maybe it's tired out too, Lena said. There was a small yellow splash of vomit on her jacket. We should stop.
From further on, Nathan called back,
"There a problem?"
Chris turned. Nathan was now 50 yards away, and she saw Nathan starting to turn the animal around.
"She bucking on you?" the old man shouted. "Want to stop and rest a while?"
"Yes," Lena muttered.
"We're fine," Chris called back.
They needed to catch up. All this shouting made him nervous. Nathan should know better, too, but they were all tired. He waved the old man on, saw Nathan's head move in a nod, and then the sorrel was angling back around and heading toward a small rise. He was just turning back to Lena when he saw Nathan's sorrel stumble, a quick hop, nothing fatal. Then something very large blurred off to Nathan's right. The shape was so out of place and so far off the ground, head height, his mind couldn't make sense of what he was seeing. The log bulleted from the woods so huge and fast it cleaved the air with a whistle.
"Nathan!" Chris shouted, but it was much too late. It had been too late the moment the sorrel stumbled over that tripwire.
The mace, a huge battering ram fashioned from a single solid log, slammed midway down Nathan's right side. The log swept through, the arc of its swing driving it completely across the trail to crash into the trees opposite. Nathan's head snapped left, some heavy bone cracked, and then his body lifted from his saddle but did not fall.
his right boot tangled in the stirrup, so when the mace's tethers spun out and caught and the swing reversed, Nathan was already slumping as the sorrel panicked and reared. So Nathan's head was just at the right spot. Maybe he was only stunned or already unconscious. It didn't matter. The heavy butt of the log smashed into Nathan's left temple with a wet, hollow thunk. This time, Nathan's head spun fast enough that Chris heard the snap as the neck broke. A jet of blood spurted from Nathan's mouth, and then a spongy black crater of gore and pulverized bone formed from the implosion of his skull. Screaming, the sorrel went down, tumbling to the snow. All this took no more than 4 seconds, but Chris was already moving after one. Nathan! He churned through the snow, his shoes slowing him down. Behind, he could hear Lena's horrified shrieks. He stumbled, then swarmed up again. This was his fault. They never should have tried moving at night, and now it was too late, too late, too late. And also too late, he remembered, where there is one booby trap, there is frequently another. His left foot plunged into the snow. An instant later, something thin bit into his shin, grew taut, and then snapped. He was pitched forward. At the last second, he rolled to take the force of the impact on his shoulder instead of his outstretched hands, but the snowshoes slowed him down. He smacked down on hands and knees, the tips of his snowshoes jammed tight in deep, hard snow. Above, he sensed movement. Then he heard a loud, snapping, crashing whirr as something barreled out of the trees. His head whipped right, but there was nothing coming for him. Not another mace, not from the side, not there. But there was something, because he heard a monstrous, splintery smash, and then he understood. Too late. The deadfall hurtled down from above, not a log like the mace, but a flat, heavy wooden square. If this had been day instead of night, and he had thought to look up instead of side to side, he still wouldn't have spotted it because of the thin, dark green net strung just below as camouflage. Now, in the green of the moon, the thing was near invisible. The tiger trap rocketed for his face. He saw nailed boards, a green twinkle of glass, the bristle of iron spikes. Chapter 81. A 5-foot time fuse with a burn rate of 45 seconds per foot meant 4 minutes, give or take, and he'd cut his in half. By the first minute, Tom was pelting downstairs. By the second, he was racing down the tunnel toward the stope where Luke ought to be. The boom was very loud, and more than just a quick double bang. The explosion tore the air, and the rock shook hard enough that a rain of dirt and grit bounced and showered from the ceiling. A few seconds later, a gush of pulverized rock and spent gases spilled into the narrow tunnel in a choking rush. Coughing against the grit, he careened down the tunnel, not bothering to be quiet, ears alert for another bigger blast, but none came. Okay. He thought the stope itself had not gone up, and that was very good. That also answered a question about the concentration of hydrogen sulfide, too. But he had a feeling that if there was another way in, this part of the mine was going to get crowded pretty soon. The clock in his head ticked. 18 minutes. Close to the stope, he smelled Luke's work as a tarry sting of nicotine. "How many more you got?" he called. Luke was just lighting up another cigarette. He sucked, the tip crisping to an angry coal. 6, he choked, and then hacked. Using duct tape, he secured the filter end of the burning cigarette to the time fuse. God, these things are nasty. Tell me about it. He'd been the only non-smoker in his platoon. I had to go through 6 brands. Then I figured it was Lucky's or bust. Keep testing brands much longer, I was going to die of lung cancer. Luke coughed out a smoky laugh. Think you blocked it off? Sure hope so. Good. Thought I heard another shot, but no one here but us. Tapping out a smoke, Tom lit up, sucked, felt the acrid taste balling in his mouth, and quickly exhaled. His mouth instantly pooled, and he turned aside and spat as he taped his cigarette to a time fuse. Not yet, anyway. Can they get here from somewhere else? I don't know, he said. Just have to hope not. Weller was waiting, propped in his corner. What do you do? The old man rasped. First I heard the shotgun, and then that explosion.
you hadn't called out, I'd have taken your head off.
Tom gave a hurried explanation, then held out his hand for Weller to grab. We got to get going. Can you walk? What about the rope? Can you manage it?
Oh, yeah. You don't worry about me.
Grimacing, the old man hauled himself to his feet.
Could have sworn I heard another shot.
Me too, Luke said. Might be the Chuckies. Is there another way around? Tom asked Weller. The old man frowned.
Shouldn't be, but maybe. Hell, they really want us. They could backtrack to the ore body and shimmy down chutes. I can't see them being that smart, though.
I don't know about that.
Tom thought back to Scarface and her little buddy with the M430s. They figured out guns. How long until one of them gets curious about a grenade launcher? Weller was slower, and it took them almost 9 minutes to get back to the very first stope. With the three of them puffing away, the room looked like a smoker's convention, but they were done in less than 1:30, and they were still alone.
We're not going to make it back to the shaft before the first charges go, Luke said. They were in the tracked tunnel, with its scatter of discarded machinery and treasure of fool's gold winking in and out of their lights, Weller at point, and Luke sandwiched between them. Ahead, Tom saw the wide mouth of the ore chute opening to the left. The boy's face flashed a look over his shoulder.
We'll be trapped.
One room shouldn't do it, Weller said, but Tom heard the note of uncertainty. No use worrying about it now. We got to...
From somewhere above came a series of muffled, throaty booms so close together they nearly sounded like one animal, but Tom knew the second room had blown. He felt the charge almost at once as the explosions raced through the rock to shake the air and shimmy up his feet into his shins. A stream of rotten rock cascaded down the walls with a sound like beans over tin, and in a few seconds his mouth was filmed with dust and grit. The air was even heavier and harder to breathe. There were new sounds, too, a kind of grinding rumble, like a distant cement mixer, and then another stranger sloshing like a gurgle.
Rock going,
Weller called, but he sounded excited now, almost gleeful.
I think we got him. I think we got those sons of bitches. I think...
To the old man's left, a jet of water suddenly spumed from the mouth of an ore chute. Not quite like the blast from a fireman's hose, the pressure was still enough to sweep Weller off his feet, and then the old man was bent over, clawing at the rock wall, unable to stand.
Holy shit! Luke shouted.
Ducking under the chute, he and Tom fished Weller out of the gush, hauled him to his feet, then battled their way further down the tunnel.
This, Tom thought, was very bad.
The water, frothy and gray, kept coming, and they were headed downhill, which meant that the water would chase them the whole way. They were also soaked through to the bone now.
What's happening?
Luke shouted over the roar. His hair was matted to his scalp, and water ran down his neck in rivulets.
Where's all the water coming from? Why is it flooding?
Tom knew, and he saw that Weller did, too. They were below the water table. The deeper levels of the mine were already underwater, and this gusher was sheeting down from somewhere else. So they might not be buried alive, or blown to bits, or even keel over from swamp gas. But they just might drown. Chapter 82. Only an idiot runs toward an explosion, but that was the way out, and there was no choice. Peeling out of the drift, she darted right, racing down the tunnel, following the flashlight away from the bodies and the blood and the stink of Daniel, of Daniel, of Daniel.
Why did you?
Tears streamed down her face. She could hear the phantom of that shot still rebounding in her brain, an echo that just wouldn't die.
Daniel, maybe it wasn't too late. Maybe you could have fought it.
She cut that off. No point. Daniel and his odor had been so close to leopards and spiders and wolves, almost a match as he changed and kept changing. She'd known that very first night. Well, it was done now. Over. Too late for Daniel, but not for her. Not yet.
Run! The bats massed in a black scream. They slapped her face, scrabbled through her hair, their nails biting into her scalp, scoring her face. She couldn't fend them off. She needed to hold the light, and there were too many of them. so she just plowed through, swimming against a panicked tide of screeching bodies. Some shot down the tunnel before her, and others just as quickly streamed the other way. She thought they were more than before, and their fear was liquid and just as sour as hers. Bats gushed out of open seams and rocketed up from jagged fissures. She ran. Her stride was awkward because of the flashlight in her left hand and the Uzi, down at hip level, in her right. She didn't kid herself. Only film gangsters and Arnold Schwarzenegger could do a full mag, an Uzi in each fist, and that was because actors pumped blanks. No kick, no climb. If she had to fire, she'd need both hands, and that meant losing the light. The Glock was a fist in her back. Its muzzle was still hot and sticky with Daniel's blood and Leopard's. She almost hadn't taken it, almost let it lie after Daniel's fingers relaxed, but then she thought of how stupid that would be. Daniel had made his choice, and now she made hers. The ground twitched, and then she heard another, longer rumble that was almost a growl, louder and closer. Another explosion. She thought it must be from ahead and above. A sudden cloud of bats belched up from an open seam to her right, like the cork blowing out of a champagne bottle under too much pressure. Her nose was full of dead Daniel and dead Leopard, but that burned match stench was much stronger, and she could feel the air rasp over her throat. Her mouth tasted muddy, and she heard the pop and grind of grit between her teeth. First a shotgun blast, and now two explosions. An attack? Someone storming the mine? She slowed for just a second. She could picture it, battling her way to the entrance, only to be cut down in a hail of gunfire. She looked every inch the changed, and she had weapons. To anyone out there, she was the enemy. No one knows I'm here. She smelled the bat's desperation and hers. If I stay and the mine does come down, if that's the plan... She had to get out, take her chances. Go up, find that big ramp again, see if maybe she could shoot her way out. No one coming yet, either. Sure, of course not. There was a lot going on, and no need to worry about her. To her right, she caught a glimpse of spray-painted numbers and thought, just ahead there's a turn, and then I ought to be at the first set of stairs, and then... As she whipped past a chute, her ears snagged on something stranger still. She skidded to a halt, backed up to the chute, put her hand to the metal, and felt the jump and skip as the metal lurched and the stone shook. Sound is physical. Vibrations cause sound that the ear's sensitive machinery translates. Even a deaf person knows sound by feel. And every kid knew chutes and ladders. Ladders you climbed, chutes shot you down. So what she was hearing now, what she felt, was happening somewhere over her head. What churned from the chute was a roar, thunderous and remorseless and unstoppable. For once, smell was unnecessary. She recognized this. Water. A lot of it. The mine wasn't just collapsing. It was flooding. Chapter 83. The deadfall hurtled down, an engine of death. Chris screamed, then he bucked, his bent legs pistoning against his mired snowshoes. He catapulted away, but it was as if he were a frog whose back legs had been pinned to a specimen board. He was locked tight. The deadfall plummeted into the snow. He felt the heavy slam against his back, and then he was sinking, the weight of the iron-spiked boards palming and forcing him down through softer snow into hard pack like a plunger squeezing grounds in a coffee press. Snow jammed into his mouth and up his nose and into his eyes, and then he was coughing, pushing the snow out and away with both hands so he could breathe. And then he stopped. The deadfall either had hung up somewhere, maybe the ropes holding it in place had snagged, or the pack had been dense enough to save him. Without the snow, the only thing that would have stopped the deadfall's downward progress would be solid ground. His pulse was thunder. He let out a breath, thought, "I'm still here." He hurt, and it was bad. He was pinned, and that might be worse. Was his back broken? He sent a command down to his feet, had a second's fright when nothing happened, but then felt his toes curl. Okay, that was good. He was alive. The spikes missed.
Too far apart? Didn't matter. He was mired in deep snow under a very heavy weight, but he was still alive. Lena was here. She could help. He'd get out of this. If I can just wiggle out. He tried to squirm forward just an inch to see. An enormous tidal wave of pain roared up his throat and crashed from his mouth. The shriek went on and on, spinning itself out on his breath. His legs were fire. His whole body was nothing but a red blaze. Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Something wet and warm leaked around his thighs, and then his brain was gabbling. Blood. I'm dead. I'll be dead in minutes. I'll bleed out. I'll... Chris! It was Lena, but he couldn't tell if she was close because he was too deep, the snow muffling sound like cotton. Bawling his fists, he gathered his breath and shouted, Lena! Stay back! That slight movement cost him. Fresh flechettes of pain cut him to the bone. And, oh God, he didn't want her to stay back. He wanted help. He needed someone to help. But if there were two booby traps, there might be a third, and if Lena was hurt or killed, he would be beyond help. His legs were pinned, and he would die for sure, either freeze to death in the snow or bleed out. Stay back! But, what should I do? How can I help? Behind him, he thought, but then he realized that she was closer. Are you on the horse? No, I... When she didn't continue, he tried to move only a little and regretted that instantly as the pain nosed down, stealing his breath. His throat locked, and then he could make no sound, not even a scream. He waited, trying to ride the pain the way a surfer followed the swell of a wave, and then the pain eased to something just the near side of agony. Ooh. Where? The word came out in a guttural croak. Did you tether it? She paused for so long he knew the answer before the words left her lips. The roan had been bucking before, and Lena wasn't that strong. It threw me. I guess it was all the noise. A pause, and then she said in a small voice, When I got close, it ran back the way we came. Oh, no. His gear, his gun. He had a knife, but it was sheathed at his waist, and he didn't know if he could reach it. Not that it would help much unless he wanted to cut his throat before a chain ripped off his head. He couldn't roll over. Even if he hadn't been tacked in place, he didn't think Lena could lift the deadfall high enough for him to squirm free. Might be the wrong thing to do anyway. He'd seen a movie about aliens landing in cornfields or something, and he remembered that when the preacher's wife got pinned to a tree by this honking huge truck, the police hadn't dared to move it because it was the only thing keeping her alive. So that might be the same thing here. Listen, he was starting to shiver, blood loss, shock, the cold. We're not far from Orin. You can make it, but you're going to need... Gear. The only gear left is with Nathan, she said. He tried to nod. He knew that. I can't, Chris. He's dead, and so is his horse, and I can't touch him. She was crying. I'm not like Alex. I'm scared. Me too. He made the mistake of trying to move and had to wait until the tidal wave of pain passed. It seemed to take longer this time, and he was panting when it let go. Sweat trickled down his cheeks to seep into the snow. You have to keep... He lost track of what he wanted to say. The words unraveled in his mouth. He laid his cheek on the snow. Just a second. Just need to rest. She said something else, but her words were just so much sound. Cottony gibberish, like the lyrics of an unknown song dribbling from someone else's earbuds, or his father swearing in electric red noise that fizzed and burned into his brain. He couldn't place the song. Those shouts had been only rage. Passing out. A blanket of sticky cobwebs drifted over his mind, the same type of gooey stuff he tore apart with bare hands to scuttle behind the furnace down in the cellar as his father rampaged and bulled through the house. A blanket of sticky cobwebs drifted over his mind, the same type of gooey stuff he tore apart with bare hands to scuttle behind the furnace down cellar as his father rampaged and bulled through the house. God
got to help her.
I'm afraid, she said again. I'll be alone.
Hurt,
he sucked in a breath.
Bad.
Forcing the words, ordering them in his mind, stole his strength. He was so tired all of a sudden and cold.
Rest soon. Help her. You... close to... Orin. Find... get help. I can't...
Chris!
I can't...
I can't help you anymore. That's what he wanted to say, but the words wadded up behind his teeth and just wouldn't come. She said his name again, and he tried to answer, tell her what to do. There was so much.
Stick, snow, search for...
He was slipping. His mind couldn't hold on.
Watch out for more traps. Careful, Lena, be...
Lena's voice was very far away.
Chris, please don't leave me.
Take gun.
Chris!
Go, Lena.
Chris!
Run.
Chapter 84.
Run! Shouldering the Uzi, she darted for the steps. She could feel the metal jumping and quivering, and then she was clattering up, taking the steps two at a time. There was a long metallic scream, a huge pop as a bolt spurted free of the stone. The ladder hitched, she slipped, sparking her right elbow against rock. The electric shock of it streamed into her hand. Another explosion, and she was knocked off her feet.
Get out, get out, get out!
She swarmed up the stairs on hands and knees. Leopard had left the gate wide open, and then she was through, jinking a hard left and running for the second set of stairs, one hand up to protect her face, crashing headlong into the bats as they streamed the other way. Dust thickened the air, and rocks showered down in a constant stream. The earth shivered and jerked. Chunks of the wall came bouncing down. Now it was a choice between the bats and the rock. One good blow to the head and she was done. Ducking, she threw up an arm to protect her head and let out a yell as stone banged off her back. Where is it? Where is it? Her panicked gaze strafed the wall, and then she saw spray paint, glanced ahead, spotted the junction. A left would take her to the stairs. Wait, was that right? Another rumble, but this time she heard the distant bang, and then the jump and tink and slide of rocks slithering down the walls. The tunnel shook, then groaned and popped as the overstressed stone began to buckle. The ground lurched, and she actually staggered as a shower of debris spilled from overhead. There came a huge, long bellow that she couldn't begin to describe, followed by a slithering hiss of rock streaming against rock, and then another louder rumble, a series of hard, insistent thumps. She had time to think that this was the sound the movies got dead on. What she was hearing were bombs going off. At the junction to her right, the tunnel crashed down. The sound was tremendous, a gray cloud pillowed in a choking smog. Her eyes stung with dust and needle-fine grit. She clapped a hand to her face. Her tongue was instantly coated with dirt, and she was retching and coughing. She staggered down the left junction, fighting the swell of dust and debris. Through streaming eyes, she saw a flash of something yellow and straight. Stairs! She stumbled up to the first landing, but she was slowing down, her lungs struggling to pull in air that would actually do her some good. The next flight of stairs was dead ahead, but the air was still thick with bats, though there were fewer now as they darted past her and back the way she'd just come. Then, over the growl of rock behind and the screech of the bats, she heard that roar again, from above and ahead. Oh my God! She stood there, paralyzed with shock and the sudden realization that the bats were going the other way because they knew what she was only now beginning to understand. Water, below, above, and coming right for her. Wheeling around, she clattered down the steps, hooked left, pushed through a fog of dust. The smell of rotten eggs had faded, and now the air was strangely sweet. She didn't think that was good. She raced after the bats, the Uzi banging against her hip. Behind, she heard water churning and splashing, and knew it was sheeting down, building to a torrent, and then she would either drown or be crushed by the rocks. She made it to the second set of steps. Another jolt as some other level or wall gave way, and she was spilling down in a tumble of stone and larger rocks.
To her mounting horror, she saw that there were more and bigger boulders in the tunnel than before. She threw herself at a tumble piled high almost to the ceiling and scurried up, digging in with hooked fingers, scrambling over the rock. The opening seemed wafer thin. Shucking the Uzi, she dropped to her belly and then socked through the weapon, the flashlight, and finally the Glock. Then she eeled, feeling the rock scour and bite her skin through the parka. She made the mistake of imagining herself caught here as the water rose and filled the tunnel all the way to the ceiling, and she panicked. Pulling in a huge breath, she screamed and kicked out with both hands and pushed and punched and batted, and then she was tumbling, bouncing, flipping down the other side. She landed on her back with a smack hard enough to drive knuckles of rock into her spine. Get up, get up, get up! Staggering, clawing her way to her feet, she bent over her thighs and dragged in a breath, choked, then dragged in another as she swept up the weapons and her flashlight. Go, go! All this rock would buy her some time, but there was a lot of water coming, and eventually that dam just wouldn't hold. The floor was strewn with loose stone. She slowed down, afraid to turn an ankle or break it. If that happened, the next bullet out of that Glock would have her name on it. Ahead, she saw a bat flash in and out of the light, heading to the left. Less than a second later, so did two more, and then so did she, wheeling into the drift she'd left only minutes before. Her light flicked over Leopard's body, then Daniel's, and then they were in her past as she scrambled further back into the drift. Air. I felt air before. I know I did. The smell of bat guano was much stronger here, and the tunnel seemed to slope up. She fanned the light right and left. The rock was streaky with bat shit. As she pushed on, the ceiling seemed lower, and soon she was crouching, duck-walking, dragging the Uzi with one hand because the tunnel was no more than 4 feet high. Then she felt the shift in the air, smelled the difference, sensed space coming up, and she slid into a large chamber. Her light strafed the walls. The room was large, maybe the size of a decent living room with a cathedral ceiling. The walls were solid, no other openings, no tunnels. Oh, hell, she aimed the flashlight toward the ceiling. Bats fly, you idiot. The way out must be there, far above and out of sight. She could never hope to climb this. Then her light snagged on a craggy horizontal bracketed by two verticals. A ladder. You watch, she darted over. It'll be a tease. It'll be broken. But the ladder wasn't, not completely, although it was wood and very old. Corroded chunks and splinters speckled the rock to mingle with a thick mat of bat droppings. Her odds were crap. She was hundreds of feet from the surface. There was no guarantee the ladder reached that far. If this tunnel slanted, she might be able to scuttle up the rocks, but she hated rock climbing. She always, always slipped. So her choices were two. Stay here and die, or try, and maybe she'd make it, or not. Maybe she'd die trying. Well, maybe. There was still the Glock. Hell, if she was really worried, she could flip that Uzi to full auto and dump that mag in 2 seconds flat. But not just yet. Hooking her hands onto the boggy wood, she began to climb, racing against time, fighting for her life. Chapter 85. Well, they weren't dead yet, not buried or gassed or drowned. Tom had miscalculated by a minute or so, and they were across the rope bridge, Weller using that one good arm and monkeying up the ladder when the big stope collapsed. They were too far away to hear it go, but they felt it. The ladder bounced and jounced under his feet, and Tom gasped as the metal balled. He heard the air split as something big, maybe a part of the shaft itself, bulleted out of the dark to his left. A second later, there was a huge whoosh as something plunged into the churning water below. "It's starting to shake!" Luke screamed. He was 5 rungs above, but now he'd frozen in place. "It's shaking! It's shaking! It's shaking!" He felt it too, a constant monstrous ripple shuddering through every bone. His body, obeying instinct and reflex, tried to lock up, but he clamped down hard. This was combat. This was exactly the same, and he would not survive if he listened to fear.
Come on! Weller roared. He was in the lead, and his voice boomed down like the voice of God. Come on, Luke! You can do it, boy!
Please, God, just get us out. He shot one glance above to make sure that Luke's feet were still moving, and then he fixed his eyes on the ladder, his arms and legs moving, always moving, hands wrapping around iron, boot pushing off against the last step. Keep moving, keep moving, keep moving. The roar was huge and constant, and they were east of the main cave-in. God only knew what was going on down there. Water crashed and spewed against stone, but he couldn't tell if that was below or from the side or sheeting down from above. Something bounced and rebounded against concrete, and he thought about all that loose stone above them. Weller had said that the last time there'd been a cave-in, the ground itself sank 100 feet. This was larger, bigger, more powerful, and it was a very, very long way to the bottom. So this might not be over, even if we make it. He was practically running up the ladder now, up and up and up. His lungs were tearing and working hard, and his muscles shrieked with fatigue, but he kept going as the ladder quivered and bounced and the water below bellowed.
Hey! Luke was shouting. I see sky! I see sky!
He spared a look, craning his head back as far as he could, and then gasped. Beyond Luke, he saw Weller's head haloed with stars. He was shocked by how close they seemed. It was like coming the wrong way out of an eye, like that movie from way back, only they'd come out through the guy's tear duct, hadn't they? Go, 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 go. He felt air now, very cold, washing down over his head and shoulders, and he heard Luke shout again. He glanced up, saw that Weller was gone, then the boy folded, and Tom saw only his feet as Luke scrambled out of the shaft. Keep going, keep going. He was 40 feet away, 30 feet, 10. He felt a hand clamp onto his left wrist, and then Weller had his right. Luke and the old man gave a mighty heave, and Tom flopped out of the shaft and sprawled belly first onto the snow. For a few seconds, all he could do was gasp, and then Luke pounded his back hard enough to jar loose his breath. We did it, Luke said. The boy was grinning and shivering at the same time. We did it! We did it! Oh, was all Tom could manage. He could feel the earth shimmying under his stomach, and far down in the shaft came the echo and rumble and roar of disintegrating stone and churning water. Hey, Luke said. He was looking to his right. I see bats, dude. The moon was setting, but enormous on the horizon, like the green eye of a giant. The bats were black, fluttery, spastic silhouettes bulleting in all directions.
Must be another opening, Weller said.
Sucking in air, he spat, then staggered to his feet.
We got to go. Cold'll get us soon, and I don't like the way the ground is shim-
A pause.
Oh, fuck me. Uh-oh.
All Tom's fatigue and relief was swept away in an instant. Weller was hunched over, propping himself up on his thighs, looking southwest and down the rise. Tom did the same, and he wasn't sure now if the shuddering in his legs was only from the ground. They weren't far away. Maybe, he squinted in the poor light, 400 yards?
How many do you think there are? Luke asked.
Can't tell. Weller glanced at Tom. We shoot it out, or we run.
We should fight, Luke said, then added, I'm not scared, just cold. We can do this.
No, Tom said.
He swung up his Uzi and peered through the scope. 7, he thought. They were spread out against the shivering snow, but they weren't coming on fast. From the way they lurched, they were having trouble on the shifting snowpack, and he thought only 2 were on skis. Of those, only 1 kid was a threat. His gaze narrowed to a laser point and fixed on the tallest Chucky. A boy, he thought. From the kick and glide, the kid knew what he was doing. Then 3 of the others from further back raised their weapons.
Down!
Tom shouted. They all flattened just as the night sparked and crackled. Tom didn't think the bullets even came close. He heard the snick as Luke thumbed the selector of his Uzi.
We could kill them, Luke said,
no shake in his voice now.
We should fight,
after all those poor people back there. They deserve to die, Tom. Wait, let's think about this. We're on a rise. Gravity is working against them and their bullets, Tom pointed. There's only that one guy who knows what he's doing. He's closest, and he hasn't taken a shot. We stick around, he will.
So we take them out now, Luke said. Please, this is for, like, everybody who died, you know?
But we don't have to fight, Luke. We still have a choice.
Well, I vote we stay, Luke said.
More sparks and crackles as the Chuckies fired. They all ducked back, but Tom knew there was no danger. These kids were firing wild.
Almost like they're trying to scare us off.
Which was strange, come to think of it.
Come on, they want to fight! They're shooting at us, Luke said.
No, they're trying to drive us off, Tom said.
Why would they do that? Luke asked.
Doesn't matter. The point is they're not firing at us yet, but in about 3 minutes they... He felt a sudden heave, as if the earth